From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, the remarkable story of the first all-female crew to compete in an around-the-world sailing race. In 1989, 26-year-old skipper Tracy Edwards set out on what was an unthinkable journey for a woman, to sail the 33,000-mile Whitbread around-the-world race. She and her crewmates renovated a beat-up racing yacht, named it Maiden, and took to sea. Male sailors and journalists thought it was inconceivable that the women would succeed.
Guys used to say to us, with absolute certainty, you're going to die. Not you might, or, you know, we think it's a bit of a risk, but, you know, you're going to die.
Edwards' race around the world is the subject of the new documentary Maiden. Also, Justin Chang reviews the new film Yesterday, directed by Danny Boyle, who made Slumdog Millionaire.
Support for this podcast comes from the Neubauer Family Foundation, supporting WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation.
In the 1980s, the world of open ocean sailboat racing was pretty much all male. That is, until our guest Tracy Edwards decided she'd assemble an all-female crew to enter the grueling and dangerous 33,000-mile Whitbread round-the-world race. As you'll hear, the idea was unthinkable to most of men in the world of yacht racing and the journalists who covered them. The remarkable story of Edwards and her crew is told in a new documentary directed by Alex Holmes titled Maiden, which was also the name of the yacht she sailed in the race. The film opens in theaters tomorrow. Tracy Edwards had an unhappy childhood after her father died and her mom remarried. She ran away from home as a teenager, made her way to Greece, and fell in love with sailing. She wanted so badly to compete that she signed on as a cook for an all-male crew on a round-the-world race. Though she learned a lot about sailing, she had no luck getting on as a crew member. She talked about her story with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.
Well, Tracy Edwards, welcome to Fresh Air. So, as I gather from the documentary, you decided you're never going to get accepted as a crew member on a round-the-world race. So you decided, well, you're just going to start your own. How did you pull that off?
Yes, I did look at the world of sailing and thought, I need to change the shape of this because I don't fit in here. And so, you know, my mum always told me, if you don't like the way the world looks, change it. So I thought, okay, I will. I thought the easiest way, that makes me laugh, the easiest way to do that would just be to put an all-female crew together. And, you know, we'll just prove we can do it and everyone will accept it and everything will be fine. But that was far from what happened. You know, we had so much obstruction and criticism and anger, which I found really quite strange. You know, why would you be angry that we want to sail around the world? We're not putting you out, we're just doing our own thing. So it was a strange process. I started out putting an all-female crew together because A, I wanted to prove that we could do it, but also so that I could be the navigator, which is it's quite a selfish reason. And then as we went on with it and people thought it was so impossible. I thought, well, I've just raced around the world. It's not that difficult.
Right. And, well, you had to figure out, well, you had to buy a boat, and I gather you had a house that you mortgaged, right, and put up and borrowed money. And then you and the women that you recruited worked on restoring this boat yourselves, and it needed a lot of work, right?
Yes, it did. We got to the point where we've been trying for so long to raise the money, the sponsorship, to design and build our own boat, which, of course, all the other crews were doing. And I realized one day that that's not going to happen. There are times where you do have to admit failure and go in a different direction. This is one of those times. And so we found an old secondhand racing yacht with a pedigree, and that was, she was called Prestige at the time, but before that she'd been Disc Door 3. And had been designed and built for Pierre Feldman in the 81-82 Whitbread Round the World race, where she hadn't actually done that well. When we bought her in the summer of 88, I mean, she was in a terrible state, and we put her on a ship and we brought her back to the UK. And then I gave the girls sledgehammers and I said, right, take her apart. And we did. I mean, we stripped the inside of the boat. We stripped the deck. We took the mast out. We took everything apart.
Was it Was it unusual for crew members to do the repairs on their own boat? Is that what the guys did?
it was absolutely unique, completely unique. All these other guys had a shore team. They had, well, they had brand new boats, so they didn't really need to do any work on them. And, you know, so they'd sit in the cafe and watch us as we were putting this boat together. Although, as I say, I mean, there was a very nice part of that sort of being part of this big Whitbread family is that if you did go and ask for help, you would 99.9% of the time you would get it. You know, you might get a bit of a snide, well, you know, if you need help kind of thing. But then, you know, we were beggars can't be choosers. But the great thing about doing what we did the way we did it was we learned everything we needed to know about the boat. We put every single item into that boat, onto that boat. We painted her. We put the rig in. We did the rigging. We did the electronics, the plumbing, the nav station, the rigging. So when we put Maiden in the water, I would say that we, us as a crew, knew our boat better than any other team in the race.
Which would come in handy later on. You got the boat, and even if you fixed it up, you still needed a lot of money because this is a race that takes months, and you need shore crews to help. And so you needed a sponsor, and typically corporations would sponsor crews. You couldn't get that. And you got some help as the result of a kind of a chance association you'd made in the past. Tell us about this.
Yeah. So I know there's bits of my life which are so surreal. I was a stewardess on a charter yacht in Newport, Rhode Island, and we had a very secretive, very important, high-profile guest, and we didn't know who it was.
This is a couple of years earlier, right? Yeah.
This is in 1984. Okay. So in 1984, I was working as a stewardess on this charter yacht. We had a surprise guest. It was all a bit weird, actually. We thought it might be Ted Kennedy. But anyway, so we went off to Martha's Vineyard. The whole boat was checked. You know, we had the Navy, we had sniffer dogs, we had divers. Then we weren't allowed to stay on the boat that night. We're like, who is this person? And it turned out to be King Hussein and Queen Noor, and they'd just been to their Prince Abdullah's graduation. And they came for a day sailing. And I was washing up after lunch, and I felt this sort of presence beside me, and I turned around, and it was King Hussein. And he had a tea towel in his hand, and I said, I don't think you can do that. He said, I can do anything, I'm king. I was like, okay. I mean, I didn't really know who he was, if I'm perfectly honest. I was 21 years old, hadn't read a newspaper since I'd left home. But there was something quite extraordinary about this man, and he was fascinated with what I did. And King Hussein was a people collector. And it wasn't just me. I mean, he collected people from all over the world, all walks of life. He found people interesting, fascinating. He loved his fellow human being. And I think that's what made him such an extraordinary leader and why Jordan is such a place of stability in the Middle East today. And he encouraged me to do the 85-86 race. And then when I was putting Maiden together, he was always there in the background, always on the end of a phone if I needed help or advice. But when I got to the point where I thought, I can't spend any more time looking for this money, you know, 2 years, and we had bits and pieces of money and donations and stuff, but no big sponsor. I called him up and I told him, and he went, oh, for goodness sake. He said, right, he said, Royal Jordanian Airlines is going to be your sponsor. And, oh, that was just brilliant. You know, we just having not to struggle for money anymore was amazing. And then, of course, she ended up this beautiful grey colour with the red and the gold stripe, because that's the colour of Royal Jordanian Airlines planes.
Ah. I have to ask, he was always on the other end of a phone. How does one dial up a king? You get a cell phone number?
He left me his phone number before he left the boat. And then before I got home to the UK, he called my mum. When I did a transatlantic home, and I got to Lymington, and of course we didn't have cell phones in those days, so I went to find a payphone. I called my mother and she said, what have you been up to? I said, nothing. I have literally just got off the boat. I've sailed across the Atlantic. She said, some guy called King Hussein keeps calling. You know, I said, oh God, please don't tell me you said you're the Queen of Sheba and put the phone down. She said, no, because knowing you, I thought there was every likelihood that it would be. So, yeah, so we forged this very strong and very close friendship. And if I ever, ever needed to speak to him, he would always get back to me or be on the end of a phone.
So you get the boat ready and you start going out and sailing and runs. And there was actually a warm-up race to the round the world race. And there's a leadership struggle in effect. I mean, your first mate, who is a very experienced sailor, you decide you have to let her go because there's a question of sort of who's really in charge of the boat. And it was kind of a tough thing. And it became a media story when you came back because it fed into the narrative of, oh, it's a catfight. These are squabbling women. And I thought we'd just hear this is a scene from the film that's where we hear a member of your crew, Jenny Mundy, talking about the kinds of questions that she and the crew and you got from the media. Let's listen.
If you looked at the questions or the articles written about us at the time, so we're always digging for stories on, well, who's boyfriend, girlfriend? Are you lesbians? Are you sleeping around? Or surely you're not getting on that well? Bunch of women on a boat that size. There must be a lot of squabbles.
What about the crew? A bunch of girls. How'd you all get on?
Remarkably well.
You never saw them ask the guys those questions. They would be asked about tactics, challenges, you know, sail, sensible sporting questions. We almost never got asked those questions. Why?
And that's Jenny Mundy. She was on the crew of the Maiden. That was the ship that was skippered by our guest, Tracy Edwards. It had the first all-female crew to compete in an around-the-world sailing race. Its story is told in the new documentary, Maiden. Were you surprised at the media reaction that you got?
We weren't surprised that there was resistance to an all-female crew in the race. You know, sailing is one of the last bastions of patriarchy, if you like, and it is entrenched. It's, you know, we're a maritime nation. It's entrenched in our history, in our warfare, in our culture, and it is extremely male-dominated. And it was, I would say, the hardest sport of any time to want to prove that women could do it. So I wasn't surprised there was resistance. The thing that really made me laugh was the two things that guys used to say to us with absolute certainty. One was, you're going to die. Not you might, or, you know, we think it's a bit of a risk, but, you know, you're going to die, which, okay, we took that with a pinch of salt. And the other one men used to say is, women don't get on. Well, what? You're not a woman and you're wrong. And, you know, it was so weird.
Yeah. One sailing journalist, Bob Fisher, called you a tin full of tarts.
Well, Bob and I are now very good friends, you'll be pleased to hear. Bob was one of the very few journalists who allowed us to change his mind. And for the documentary, I have to say, he did a wonderful job of being very honest about what he thought then, you know, and he could have ducked it, but he didn't. He really stepped up to the plate. But when we sailed into New Zealand in first place, Bob Fisher then wrote in Yachts and Yachting, not just a tin full of tarts, a tin full of smart, fast tarts. And we all thought this was great. You know, oh, yay, Bob's changed his mind. And then someone said to us, you do know that tart is still in that sentence. You know, we're like, oh, yeah. Okay, well, maybe a little bit further to go.
You know, one of the things that struck me as I looked at the film, there's a lot of clips of you doing media interviews. And I have to say, you seem very composed and on message. I mean, you don't rail at people. You don't rage at the criticism that you have been given. Did you get advice on this? Did it just come naturally?
That is such a good question. You know, the first thing I thought when I first watched this documentary with all the other women, and we all said, to almost a woman, the same thing. I looked at myself on that screen and I thought, well, that's not me. I have no link with that person, this young person up on the screen, because I remember myself as being a bit of an idiot and a bit of a twit, really. And I have this sort of almost horrible reoccurring dream about me being just kind of lurching from one situation to the next and, you know, fighting the next obstacle. And then we watched that and I thought, I actually sound quite sensible in some of the interviews. And, you know, I say a couple of quite profound things. And to me, I don't remember myself like that. And the only thing I can think, and I didn't have any media training, the only thing I can think is, I mean, my mum and Admiral Charles Williams, who was the organiser of the Whitbread, who was a huge supporter of Maiden, and he was so wonderful. Admiral Charles Williams. Yes, of course, women can sail around the world. He was just wonderful. He did take me aside a couple of times and say, you know, yeah, you can't do a press announcement and then run out of the room. You know, you do have to stay for questions and little tips like that. But I was told right from day one, don't lose your temper, because I, at the time, did have just a little bit of a temper, I have to say. So I'm amazed when I watch that footage, because I think I probably know what's going on beneath the surface.
And there's one moment, which I'm told you cringe when you see now, where you're asked, are you a feminist? And you say, I hate that word.
Yeah.
What was, I could kind of get what you were saying, but you tell me.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the 80s, feminist was an accusation. It wasn't a nice title. It had all sorts of horrible connotations, and really it had been made into a word that women should be ashamed of, I think with deliberate reason. And, you know, I'd drunk the Kool-Aid, basically, and I was very young. I was 23, 24 during that interview. And I didn't want people not to like me. You know, you care very much at that age that people like you. I mean, you may be annoying them and putting this all-female crew together, but I do remember afterwards my mum said to me, I am so surprised that you don't think you're a feminist. And she said, I'm not going to tell you what you should say. She said, but I think you need to have a bit of a think about that one. And then when we again got to New Zealand and we'd won that leg and we were getting the same stupid, crass, banal questions that we had on every other leg, I just thought, you know what? I think this is bigger than us and bigger than Maiden and bigger than you know anything we've been tackling. This is about equality. And I think I am a huge fat feminist. I think I absolutely am. And I stood up for the first time in my life and I said something that might hurt me and might make me not likable. And I took pride in it. And it was an extraordinary experience.
When you were working as a cook on the otherwise all-male crew of that round-the-world race back then, when you observed the men on the boat and how they interacted with one another, I'm wondering if that was different from your observations of all-women crews that you saw later on?
It's very smelly. It's very messy. You know, there's a lot of swearing, and then there are days when guys don't talk to each other. What is that? So that was very weird. A lot of tension, testosterone, egos. I mean, it was an interesting experience that 9 months. You know, first time and last time I'd ever been, you know, with 17 men and sort of watching them in their environment, if you like, you know, their natural habitat. So it was, I had nothing to compare it to at that time, but then doing an all-female crew, then I noticed, wow, there's a huge difference between a group of women and a group of men.
Right. And how would you describe the difference?
Well, I prefer sailing around the world with an all-female crew. I prefer, you know, sailing with women anyway. Much cleaner. You know, we do tend to wash, you know, even if it's in cold salt water. The more use of deodorant as well, I have noticed. But we were always chatting, always talking. I mean, I know people say women talk a lot. We really did, and we did talk the whole way around the world. I don't think there's one subject that we didn't cover in depth, inside, outside, and backwards. Women are kinder to each other, and in a much more obvious way. So, you know, we're naturally more nurturing and caring, I think. And if you saw someone scared or worried or anxious or a bit down, there'd always be someone, you know, that would put their arm around your shoulder and go, cup of tea? Yes, please. Thank you very much. So just a completely, completely different atmosphere. And I do think that each flourish in their own atmosphere. You see, that's the thing. I have done mixed crews, which have worked really, really well. But I think at that time, it really was each to their own.
Right. The thing that I wondered was whether women are just simply more willing to cooperate, and a crew really has to work together on a long voyage like that.
I think the one time when we didn't talk was the time when we were cooperating the most, which was on the start lines. And it was very interesting, actually. We didn't notice we did this at all, because we trained a lot. We trained. And then when we were on the start line, you've got a lot of screaming and shouting. There's a lot of very macho posturing, you know, between the boats, and it's all sort of playing chicken, and it's there's a lot of shouting.
You're all close together there, right?
Because you're all close together. But what we didn't realise until we got to the next stopover, one of the guys said, "Oh, you girls not talking to each other on the start line then? It was, you know, you're not talking to each other already." And we went, "Yeah? What do you mean?" He said, "Well, no one was saying anything or shouting anything." I said, "Well, we don't like being shouted at, so therefore we tend not to shout at each other." And then we realised when we're sailing in those quite stressful conditions, we were completely silent because we were so in harmony with each other.
We're listening to the interview Dave Davies recorded with Tracy Edwards. In 1989, she became the first woman to lead an all-female sailing crew on the Whitbread Round the World race. That voyage is the subject of the new documentary Maiden. After a break, they'll talk about the dangers and the extremes the crew faced during the race. And Justin Chang will review the new movie Yesterday, whose conceit is that a strange blip has erased the Beatles from history, with the exception of one singer-songwriter who remembers the band and their songs. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from E-Trade. With all the jargon, investing can feel like a foreign language. E-Trade makes investing simple by providing personalized support and guidance in terms you can understand. They let you get started in the market with as little as $500 and then help you learn as you go. You don't need to be a pro to invest at E-Trade. For more information, visit etrade.com/NPR. E-Trade Securities, LLC. Member SIPC.
Let's get back to the interview Fresh Air's Dave Davies recorded with Tracy Edwards, who in 1989 was the first woman to lead an all-female sailing crew on the Whitbread Round the World race.
This first leg of the journey from England to Uruguay, you finished third out of the four boats in your class. And the journalists who thought you wouldn't even get there were giving you a well done sort of treatment. You didn't feel that way, right?
No. We were absolutely gutted when we came third. We were so disappointed. So we had this really weird situation going on the dock. So we were coming in with a face as low as I don't know what. And then everyone else on the dock was going, "You're alive! You're alive!" So we had this really strange party with a very happy group of people and a very grumpy group of people. It's very weird.
The second leg of the journey is from Uruguay to Australia. It's the longest, and you're kind of sailing across the bottom of the world if you kind of turn the globe over and picture it. So the most direct route would be kind of as close to the South Pole as possible. That gets tricky. That imposed a tough decision on you. Tell us what, you know, the trade-offs were and the challenges.
Well, you don't just stop in port, you continue to work, and the girls are fixing the boat and themselves. And I just either sat in my room in the hotel with all my charts and everything else, or on the boat in the nav station, and you're planning your next leg, and you're looking at different things like, what does the weather look like that's coming up? What is the sea state currently in the Southern Ocean? Where are the icebergs? They were particularly far north that year. And you're looking at long-range forecasts and trying to piece all these things together. And so what you want to do is, yes, you want to go as far south as possible, but, and the reason why others made the decision not to was because of the icebergs. Now, I made quite a risky decision that we wouldn't hit an iceberg, and I took us the furthest south of any boat in the Whitbread fleet that year. But I was very clear on what I wanted to do and why I wanted to do it. What you don't want to do is go so far south that you go over the Antarctic shelf, which then changes the shape of the waves and can make them quite unmanageable. And you also don't want to get on the wrong side of the low pressures, which is to go south of them. You want to stay north of them because they travel clockwise. So it was a hugely fraught leg on the decision-making front, but I was probably the clearest I'd ever been about anything in the race, and I got it right.
Okay, so this crew, this is not a balmy Caribbean sail. I mean, you're going to save time, but conditions are... Well, I think one of you said there's nothing that can prepare you for sailing in the Southern Ocean. Can you just describe a little bit about what it was like, what the crew had to put up with?
Okay, so the conditions in the Southern Ocean is your body starts to deteriorate as soon as you cross the start line. Pain and cold are the quickest ways to lose weight. You can get frostbite in your fingers and toes. It's minus 20, minus 30 degrees below freezing. You are constantly damp because salt water doesn't dry. So the girls up on deck would be miserable. Cold, wet, miserable. You know, freezing fingers and toes. Tons of clothing on so you can barely move. The food's revolting, so you just shovel it down your throat as quickly as possible and try and get as much sleep as possible with this four-on, four-off watch system. And it's also a sensory deprivation. There's no sun, there's no blue sky, it's grey, and the boat's grey, and everything's grey, and it is a miserable leg.
And you have to look out for ice, and sometimes it's foggy, and sometimes it's at night. What, do you place someone on the bow? How does that work?
Yep, so you have a bow watch. We realized when we had woken up, well, when I'd woken up and the girls were already staring at it, but I went up on deck and we were sailing past an iceberg and I said, oh my God, I didn't see that on the radar. And they went, nope, we didn't either. So that's when we thought, yeah, we need to have someone up on the bow, just because it just gives you that few seconds more of warning if you see an iceberg and you have to swerve.
Right, so you're not within sight of any of the other boats, obviously, and you finally get to the calmer waters as you approach Australia. Describe getting into Australia and realizing where you were.
Well, coming up towards Australia, a number of things happen when you come out of the Southern Ocean. A, well, obviously it gets warmer as you're heading up towards Australia. The sea state changes. The color of the sea goes from a black to this beautiful, deep, translucent blue. The sky, you can see the sky again. It actually has a definition between the sea and, the clouds. You suddenly remember all these things that you haven't seen for 5 weeks. And then, obviously, as I say, it gets warmer. You start to dry everything out. And as you get closer to land, as Jenny says in the film, land smells. And, you know, for quite a way out, you can smell what's coming up. And that's quite amazing. And it is like being reborn. And as we came up to Australia, we did not know whether we had won. We suspected we were in first place, but we didn't know until we crossed the finishing line. And Howard was on one of the boats shouting, "You're first!" And we just were. Oh, that was, I think, probably the happiest moment of my entire life.
The third leg is the shortest. It goes from Australia to New Zealand. And that's a different kind of sailing. It's sort of tactical. You're often within sight of the other boats. You win again. Describe arriving in New Zealand.
Oh, it was just amazing. We knew we had to win this leg to prove that we could do a long, hard leg and a short, complicated leg. And I had three great tacticians on board, and we did match race pretty much the whole way there with L'Esprit and then with Rocknor. And when we got into New Zealand, we'd been delayed by the wind dropping and it was nighttime. So we actually ended up getting in at 1 o'clock in the morning. It wasn't again until we crossed the start, the finishing line that someone said, you know, you've won. And we were so happy. Only by an hour this time, whereas the previous time had been 36 hours. So we were now 16 hours ahead of our nearest rival at the halfway point. And when we did turn the corner to motor into the port that we were going into, there was a wharf and we thought that it was covered with thousands of birds. And it was only when we got closer that we realised it was people. Thousands and thousands of people had come out in Auckland at 1 o'clock in the morning to see Maiden Inn. And it was just amazing.
So you had become famous. I mean, I guess this was in some respects kind of a novelty story in some way. But suddenly people are rooting for you and you're winning.
It was, yeah. I mean, I think we still stayed a novelty for some people, although for a lot of people, they started to wake up and go, wow, actually women can do this.
Tracy Edwards' remarkable experience as skipper of the first all-female crew to compete in and around the world sailing race is told in the new documentary, Maiden. It opens in theaters this Friday. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Zoom. When you can't be there in person, Zoom. Zoom is used by millions to connect face-to-face, across town, or around the world. Share files, video, anything, and connect through any device, desktop, laptop, tablet, smartphone, or conference room system. Zoom video conferencing, Zoom rooms, Zoom video webinars, and Zoom phone lets you do business at the speed of Zoom. Visit Zoom online to set up your free account today. Meet happy with Zoom.
This week marks the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising, a turning point in the movement for LGBTQ rights. So in this week's episode of the StoryCorps podcast from NPR, we'll revisit the very first documentary our founder, Dave Isay, made back in 1989, called Remembering Stonewall. Listen and subscribe now.
This is Fresh Air, and we're speaking with Tracy Edwards. She assembled and led the first all-female sailing crew to compete in an around-the-world race in 1989. That's the subject of the new documentary, Maiden. It opens in theaters this Friday. The fourth leg of the race began not so well for you and the others on the Maiden. You had calm waters that prevented you from really getting a good start. And I thought we'd play a clip that describes the part where you were going around, I guess it's the Falkland Islands, and some of the seas that you met. In this clip, we'll hear from members of the crew, Claire Warren, Dawn Riley, Jenny Monday, and the clip begins with our guest, Tracy Edwards. Let's listen.
We went around Cape Horn, and then there was, you know, the possibility of some options opening up for us to be able to pick up some ground. So I decided to go for it.
Turning up and going up past the Falklands, it got a bit busy. There's only been a few times in my life that it had been that rough.
Often on a boat, you know, you'll find the shortest distance is straight into the wind, for example. Well, boats don't sail into the wind, so how far off do you go?
It's like hitting a brick wall in a car without your seatbelt on every 10 seconds. It's just relentless.
There's a lot of slamming. Boom, bang, boom, bang. It takes a lot out of the boat.
And that's from the new documentary, Maiden, which features the voyage led by Tracy Edwards, our guest. It was the first all-female sailing crew to compete in an around-the-world race in 1989. It is powerful watching those scenes of essentially sort of surfing down one side of a wave and then slamming into another. How dicey did this get? How did the boat take it?
It was an all-or-nothing decision. It was, you know, it could have been the wrong one, but we just had to do something. And so we all decided to go for it. What it did do was it opened up four hairline fractures in the mast, which we couldn't see at that time and didn't know they were there. But I was in the nav station one evening, and I suddenly found water around my feet. And as we were going past the Falkland Islands, we had started taking on a lot of water. And I mean a lot of water. It was pouring in. We spent 2 days trying to find out where this water was coming in, and we hove to, which means you come off away off the wind and you calm things down a bit. You take a couple of sails down. An RAF Hercules was scrambled from the Falkland Islands just to check where we were in case we needed to be rescued.
That's an airplane dispatched from by the British in the Falklands, right?
That's exactly. Right. So after about 2 days, we managed to get rid of most of the water, and we realized that it was worse leaning over one side than it was leaning over the other side. And we managed to get on our way, but that lost us so much time. There was no way we could catch up on our lead at that point.
Yeah, I mean, this problem appeared with water at your feet in the navigation station, right? And did the fact that you and your crew had effectively kind of built the boat over again inside out, did that matter in diagnosing the problem and resolving it?
Oh, without a doubt. If we hadn't rebuilt that boat, we wouldn't have known where to start. And as Jenny so eloquently puts in the film, it's one of my favourite lines when she says, you know, you can't then just give up and call the repair people. There are no repair people. I just love that so much. And of course, you know, I mean, Jenny knew every inch of the boat. She was the electrician and she'd run every cable. And we'd all done our separate areas. So we felt, okay, it was worrying, but we felt very confident that we were sorted out and we would get to the next stopover.
The last two legs, you didn't do as well as you had in the previous two and ended up finishing second in your class out of four, right, when you sailed to England? Is that right?
Yes.
Pretty good showing, you know, considering what people were expecting. As you arrived, you weren't feeling that, right?
No, I mean, we came second in our class overall, which is the best result for a British boat since 1977 and actually hasn't been beaten yet. But that didn't mean much to us at the time. We were going through, when you finish a race like that, you go through a mixture of emotions. Obviously, if you're winning, it's all happiness and wonderful and fantastic. We hadn't won, we'd come second. And it took me a long time to come to terms with that because second is nowhere in racing. But as Claire says in the film, you know, and she's very right, there was a bigger picture. And the bigger picture was what we had achieved. The other thing I think that happens to you as you finish a race of that length is you suddenly realize that this family of people that you have been with for 3 years is suddenly going to disappear. And that is, it's quite shocking and can be depressing.
Right. That's 3 years total. I guess, what, 9 months or so on the ocean, pretty much?
Yeah.
Right. When you arrived in England, when you're sailing in, you knew that you weren't going to be there first. You did get a reception of sorts. You want to describe this?
Well, it was quite just extraordinary. We finished on bank holiday Monday, which is a good day to finish. And as we were coming up towards the Needles, which we hadn't seen for 9 months, it was sunrise. There wasn't really that much wind. And we were so close to, you know, this is it, final stretch. And as we were going up Southampton Water, hundreds of boats came out to meet us. And they would come towards us, turn around, then start sailing with us. So the final 2 hours of the boat was 2 hours I will never forget as long as I live, surrounded by thousands of people on hundreds of boats, throwing flowers and cheering and... It was absolutely amazing. And crossing the finishing line, we knew, okay, we hadn't won, but we had sailed into the history books and we are first and you can't beat being first to do something. So, and then coming into Ocean Village where 50,000 people were waiting for us was just phenomenal. Most amazing, extraordinary experience.
You know, we wouldn't have this documentary if there weren't a lot of film taken, or video, I guess, taken on the boat itself. This is real footage done on the voyage in 1989. How did that happen?
Well, the Whitbread organizers wanted some of the boats to take cameras, and most of the guys' boats were far too important and busy to take cameras and film. So, you know, we stuck our hands up and said, we'll film. And so they gave us a camera and then we said, oh, who is going to film? And Joe, who was the cook and my school friend, she said, well, I'd love to film. I'm the cooking. I don't do a watch. So we packed her off to the BBC with a camera for 4 days. 4 days. I mean, just extraordinary. And then she came back to the boat and you know, we practiced before we went, which again is something the guys' boats didn't really do, even if they had cameras. We worked out that we needed a camera fixed on the radar mast for emergency situations when Jo couldn't film because we needed her on the deck as a crew member. And Jo has an amazing emotional intelligence, and her connection with her subjects, which is us, is what makes this whole film so completely unique. And Alex says without her footage, he wouldn't have been able to make the documentary he made.
When the Maiden arrived back in England, you were named Yachtsman of the Year. Still Yachtsman, not... You were named Yachtsman of the Year. Quite an honor. And you were a national celebrity. I mean, at age, what, 27? What were your plans from then? I mean, you'd accomplished this remarkable thing.
Well, I didn't have any plans, and that's unfortunately did not go well. So the girls all disappeared quite quickly. They'd been made job offers, and I said rather gallantly and stupidly, "Oh well, I'll stay here and I'll write the book and I'll do the interviews and I'll, you know, sort of keep the story going." And I fell off a cliff, really, and within, I would have to say, how long? Within 9 months of the race finishing, I'd had a nervous breakdown. And if you'd have asked me this question even 2 years ago, I would not have told you that. But we're talking a lot about mental health in the UK and about well-being and caring for ourselves. And I didn't ask for help. And I was struggling badly without my teammates around me. And so I disappeared off down to Wales, and I stayed there for 2 years and really became a recluse, to really to the point where the whole sailing world wondered where the hell I'd gone, before reappearing in 1994 with a new sailing project.
Right. I'm curious how you look back on that crisis. I mean, as I hear the story, I mean, you'd gone a long time without a real family, and then you found it with this crew, and then suddenly they were gone.
It was very hard saying goodbye to everyone, and I still get emotional when I talk about it today, really. It was a time when my lesson that I learned from that was really to ask help when ask for help when you need it. And, you know, there's nothing big about pretending to be brave. That's just stupid. So the lesson I learned on the race was that friendship and teamwork are the two most important things. And the thing I learned after the race was, if you have that teamwork and that friendship, ask for help.
Well, it's been great talking to you. Tracy Edwards, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tracy Edwards spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. Edwards and her all-women crew that competed in the 1989 Whitbread Round the World race are the subject of the new documentary Maiden, which opens in theaters tomorrow. After we take a short break, Justin Chang will review the new movie Yesterday that imagines a world in which the Beatles were erased from cultural memory, with the exception of one aspiring singer-songwriter who starts performing Beatles songs. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from ExxonMobil, the company that believes that carbon capture technologies are critical for lowering global CO2 emissions. And more scientists agree. As a leader in capturing emissions in its own operations, ExxonMobil is working on ways to make this technology more efficient and affordable for other industries as well. That's the unexpected energy of ExxonMobil. Find out more at energyfactor.com. Support for NPR comes from WHYY, presenting the podcast Eleanor Amplified, an adventure series kids love and will make those summer road trips a little easier on everyone. Hear reporter Eleanor outwit crafty villains and solve mysteries as she travels the globe to get the big story. Available where you get podcasts or at WHYY.org.
The new movie Yesterday imagines a parallel reality where the Beatles and their music are suddenly erased from memory, with the exception of one aspiring singer-songwriter played by Himesh Patel. The film is directed by Danny Boyle, from a script by Richard Curtis, with a cast featuring Lily James, Kate McKinnon, and the musician Ed Sheeran. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
I'll say this much for the breezy but dispiriting musical romance Yesterday. It has a clever conceit that it doesn't make the mistake of trying to explain. What explanation could there be for how the Beatles suddenly vanished from history, leaving behind only one lonely fan who remembers some of the greatest rock and roll songs ever written? Like a lot of surreal comic fantasies, the movie just invites you to shrug and go along with its cheerfully ridiculous premise. I was glad to do so, up to a point. The lead actor, Himesh Patel, best known for the British soap opera EastEnders, has an engaging presence and a lovely singing voice. There are worse ways to pass 2 hours than listening to Patel warble more than a dozen of the Beatles' biggest hits, even if he's no match for John, Paul, George, and Ringo. But the movie is directed with uncharacteristic blandness by Danny Boyle, who brought so much more dynamism to movies like Slumdog Millionaire and Steve Jobs. And the screenwriter Richard Curtis, the one-man British whimsy factory behind Love Actually and Notting Hill, seems less interested in exploring the Beatles' cultural legacy than in trapping his characters in another one of his patented rom-com formulas. Patel plays Jack Malik, a young man from the English county of Suffolk, who's about to give up on his dreams of a music career, despite the encouragement of his best friend and part-time manager, Ellie, played by Lily James. While riding his bike home one night, Jack gets hit by a bus and knocked unconscious, right at the moment of an inexplicable worldwide power outage. He makes a speedy recovery, but the world around him has irrevocably changed. Jack realizes this when he's playing his guitar for Ellie and some other friends. He decides to perform the Beatles' 1965 hit Yesterday, and the others are awestruck by what they assume is his own composition.
Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday.
When did you write that?
I didn't write it. Paul McCartney wrote it. The Beatles.
Who?
After running several frantic Google searches, Jack confirms that the impossible has happened. Somehow, the Beatles never became the Beatles, and immortal songs like Let It Be, I Want to Hold Your Hand, and Hey Jude were never written. Until now, of course. After frantically scribbling down all the lyrics he can remember, Jack begins performing the Beatles songs, passing them off as his own. His appearance on a local TV program captures the attention of none other than Ed Sheeran, who gives a sharp, self-effacing performance as himself. Sheeran is floored by this newcomer's obvious talent and makes him his opening act, which is all Jack Malik needs to become an overnight sensation. Jack's meteoric rise is meant to tell us something, namely that the appeal of the Beatles' music is so universal that it can captivate anyone, anytime, and anywhere. That's easy enough to believe, but Yesterday handles the music so clumsily that it almost gives you reason for doubt. Patel sings beautifully. He does an especially stirring rendition of In My Life. But the movie chops most of the songs up into fragments and litters them almost interchangeably throughout the story. It so takes our affection for the Beatles for granted that it never bothers to give the music a proper showcase. It doesn't let those songs soar and seduce us anew. In reducing the Beatles' catalog to a greatest hits cover album, Yesterday disregards some of the more intriguing possibilities of its goofy premise. What would the state of contemporary popular music even begin to look like if one of its greatest, most influential pillars had been removed? Because they're making a lightweight pop confection, the filmmakers don't expect you to trouble yourself with such concerns. But the questions they force us to dwell on are so much more banal by comparison. Will Jack and Ellie end up together in the end? Can world-famous celebrities ever be compatible with the working-class nobodies they fall in love with? It was a compelling enough dilemma in Notting Hill, but by now the Richard Curtis template is starting to wear awfully thin. Kate McKinnon does give the movie a welcome blast of comic energy as Deborah, a witheringly cynical music agent who takes Jack on as her latest client. Art is simply product to Deborah. Again and again, she tells Jack he's going to be rich beyond his wildest dreams. So long as the money keeps rolling in, she couldn't care less about what the Beatles songs mean or where they came from. She sums up this movie's worldview all too perfectly.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. If you'd like to catch up on Fresh Air interviews you missed, like our interviews with comic and actor Rami Youssef about being the son of Egyptian immigrants and an observant Muslim who doesn't observe all the rules, or with Dr. Paul Volberding and Nurse Cliff Morrison about caring for AIDS patients in the early days of the epidemic, check out our podcast. You'll find lots of Fresh Air interviews.
1, 2, 3, 4!
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.